Hey everyone, this is Camden. Before we get into today's episode, I want to introduce you to five more talents. You may have heard about them, but they're a significant organization that's doing valuable work for churches today. They've been around since 2009, and Five More Talents has been partnering with churches to develop websites, helping more than 150 confessional, Presbyterian, and Reformed churches establish a strong online presence. You know this is tough, and a lot of churches struggle to develop such a presence. America also is rapidly de-churching, and many congregations are feeling the weight of this shift, but Five More Talents is here to help. Now, you might be surprised, but more people are searching online for churches and for spiritual answers than ever before. And now, with Five More Talents, your church can connect with them in new ways. So join Five More Talents' free online community. You can also participate in their free webinars. And if you do so, your church can receive step-by-step guidance on how to reach unchurched people in your community. But Five More Talents goes beyond website development as well. They help churches fulfill the Great Commission in a digital age. Visit fivemoretalents.com to learn more. Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 885. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in the Reformed Forum HQ in Libertyville, Illinois, North Chicagoland. And I always get annoyed when I hear old episodes and we mention the weather, but man, is it cold today. It was 4 when I got out of bed and went for a run, and a negative 7 wind chill, unpleasant. But we're in the office. We've got heat. We're very thankful. We've got some great folks with us today to talk about an important subject. We're going to be talking about mission work and the work of John G. Payton, particularly. I have with me our Director of Education and Advancement here at Reformed Forum, none other than Ryan Noah. Welcome, Ryan. It's great to see you.
Thanks so much, Camden. I'm elated to be here with you and with our special guest.
Amen. Yeah, you turned me on to this subject, John G. Payton. You were reading his autobiography, and then we came to find that we have a new docu-series episode featured. We're going to talk about that episode and the series and the organization that put it out, and to do so, we have with us our friend Chad Vegas, founding pastor of Sovereign Grace Church in Bakersfield, California. He's also a founding board chairman at Radius International and involved in missionary and some other organizations. Welcome, Chad. It's good to see you today.
It's good to be with you, Camden.
Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us. We're really excited to have you to talk about missions, to talk about the work that is before the church. We know that Christ is with us to the end of the age, but we know that his gospel, his word's going to proceed throughout the whole world. We've spoken before, even on this program, about the work that you're engaged in and the work that Radius International is seeking to train people to go do. But we're going to have a follow-up with that today. So back in October, so for some context, we were at a conference in Jacksonville hosted by missionary, and we'll talk a bit about that and to speak about the docuseries that was launched and published and announced all at that conference. It was a really fun event. But I got a couple things. I'm reminded. I got a couple things I got to mention, some news and bits before we get into the main subject matter today. So for the people that are following along, we just hosted had a big sale for Black Friday. So we hope that many of you already know about these books and already have them. But for those who don't, stay tuned. We've got Fullness of Joy, a brand new book from Reformed Forum written by Daniel Ragusa. It is a biblical theology of God with us. It's the perfect size to stick in a stocking if you want to give for Christmas. We're also selling 10 packs of this for study groups. And we have a free, entirely free video course that corresponds to this class chapter by chapter. So if you're interested in studying this personally or as a family or perhaps as a group at your church, this is a great, great book. What would you say, Ryan? I mean, it's just a tremendous book. It's really strikes a balance between theological depth. So it's, you know, it's people like you and I have gone to seminary, we read it and enjoy it and benefit from it, yet at the same time, it doesn't scare people away.
Right. Yeah. This will sweep you up into the drama of redemption. Dan is he's following the master storyteller himself and just bringing you into the history of Special Revelation in a way that you can't but be filled with joy. If you have the Holy Spirit, you will enjoy this book.
Mm-hmm. We also have Order in the Offices. This is a big one. People are really talking about this and excited about this. We're hoping to strike a healthy controversy. So this is a book that advocates for a three office view that we have of continuing office, continuing special office of ministers, elders, and deacons. Obviously, we acknowledge that Messiah is still in office held by one and will never cease. So if you want to be technical, I guess we would advocate for a four office view. And then you have the general office of the priesthood of all believers. So there's five. But generally speaking, we're talking about ministers, elders, and deacons. And there has been a bit of a debate throughout history, but typically the more historical view is that ministers and elders are a distinct office. But then you have people who hold to a two office view that says they're the same, but maybe are performing different functions. And then you have the view that's affectionately known within the PCA, for example, as the two and a half office view. So if you're interested in those subjects or would like to learn more about the historical views and get into even exegesis of particular passages, this is an excellent book. It was published in the 90s, but we have a second edition that Reformed Forum has been privileged to publish. And as you can see, we have it in hardcover. It's beautifully done, if I may say so myself. We have it in Smithsonian binding, cloth covered. Really great design. The typesetting's excellent. And we've got some great endorsements from David Hall, Cornelis Van Damme, and Cornelis Venema. We got the dual Cornelis squared. You're really rocking and rolling here. So this book is something we're trying to get more people to talk about. Whether you're a three-office person or not, I really believe this is an excellent book that you ought to read and become familiar with the arguments. So even if you're reading it in order to sharpen yourself against objections, I hold to a three-office view, and I'd like other people to as well, but I'm just advocating this as an important work, just a really important work on the subject. So if you're into ecclesiology, if you're into studying offices and trying to understand passages like,
First Timothy 5:17,
Titus, all the qualifications for elders and what do elders and ministers do, this is a great book. So pick one of those up as well. Brand new, Order in the Offices, second edition, Essays Defining the Roles of Church Officers. And last thing before we get into the main subject today, we certainly want you to join us, should be next Friday, for our first annual. Now, I know I'm not supposed to say first annual, according to my wife, but I'm doing it because I'm so confident that this is going to be something we want to do every year. Ryan and I hatched up a crazy idea where we're going to have a Christmas party, but instead of just having one in the office, we're going to host a four-hour live stream event on our YouTube channel from noon to 4 p.m. Central Standard Time on Friday, December 20th, 2024, for those of you who may be listening well into the future. And we have a whole series of guests. We've got our Reformed Forum faculty, Lane Tipton, Carlton Wynn, Jim Cassidy, myself will be online, and some of us in studio. We've got all sorts of people from the Chicagoland area, even coming from the Green Bay area. We'll welcome them across the border, even though they kick our butts every year and block our end of game field goals. We'll still have Steve Schmidt coming in, and we've even got musical guests. So Pam York is set up to play a brief set of jazz, playing some Christmas arrangements. And it's going to be great. It's like a throwback, Chad, to an old school telethon. And we've got all these different guests and different segments lined up, even some games. We're going to be playing a Reformed version of Wits and Wagers. Steve Schmidt's going to host. And then I've got a fun game lined up where I'm going to host a game. I've called it Chronicles or the NFL. So I'm going to say a name, and our studio guests have to determine whether that name is from First or Second Chronicles or an NFL active roster or both. And there are many that are both. So we'll let people sharpen their knowledge and get ready for this fun game. But it's all fun. We're going to talk theology. We've got people lined up got a minister, Kurt Federle from Switzerland, lined up to call in and talk about the work of the Great Commission there. We've got James Chu from the Philippines, who's going to call in and talk about the work that's going on over there. We've got Ruth Huang, who's going to talk about some other important work and translation efforts in Asia. So we're really, really looking forward to this. So if you're interested in that, check out reformedforum.org. Right on the homepage, you'll see a link to our Christmas extravaganza. It's entirely free. It's online. It's going to be, again, from noon to 4 p.m. Central Standard Time. For those who don't ever have to do adjustments, that's 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern. You'll be able to join us. And I guess that would be, what are we looking at here? 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time for Chad. So anyway, we're really excited about that. Take a look. The schedule's posted online, and we'd love to have you. YouTube.com/Reformed Forum for the live stream. All right. Thank you for putting up with that, Chad. We appreciate your time, your patience, and we're extremely excited to talk about the Great Commission. It's related. We're talking to some internationals, and we know that you are heavily at work with people who are doing all sorts of work around the world. I'd love if you could remind people a bit about Radius International. I will have a link to the episode that we recorded when we were at the Greenville conference back in March. So if people want a story of the founding of that and the particular type of training that you're offering to missionaries, I will refer them to that detailed episode, which was a total blast. But I'd love for you maybe to remind people, at least in a thumbnail sketch, about Radius International, but even more so to introduce and explain missionary. You can head over to missionary.com for more information. But Chad, what are these organizations and what are you seeking to do?
Yeah, so Radius International is an organization that was started for the purpose of training people to go to the most difficult places on earth to take the gospel. So when I say that, I don't just mean difficult in the sense that they're difficult places to live because they're often closed countries and the weather's unpleasant and the diseases, you know, are pretty out of control and those kinds of things. I mean difficult in the sense that there is no Christian witness in that language. And what I mean by that is there's no church, there's no Bible, there's no Christian minister there. There's just, it's a language group that has no access to the gospel whatsoever. So there's a difficulty in getting there on a number of levels, from entering that country, learning the majority language so you can get into those places, and then going and learning that minority language. And oftentimes, having to create a written language for them, having to teach them how to read it, having to translate into that language, and teach them the Bible story and plant the church, translate, you know, all that work. So we started Radius International to specifically train people in the skills necessary to do that work. We're not replacing a seminary or a Bible college. We're not trying to do any of that work. We're really supposed to be augmenting that. So if think about it like this, Camden, you pastor a church, you go to seminary to become a pastor, but that doesn't mean you know how to acquire a language or a couple of languages,
right?
Create a written orthography for that language, translate the Bible into that language, deal with cross-cultural church planting questions. And there's a variety of things there, how to get a visa in a closed access country, how to hide your identity there, so that you have a legitimate identity that's true, but that doesn't, you know, get you imprisoned or ejected or what have you. So all of that work, your seminary isn't teaching. So we're trying to, we essentially started these programs to teach that. So Radius has campuses in Mexico that are in English, so that you're trained there in the morning and then in the afternoon, you're out using the linguistic skills you've been being taught, practicing them. And then we have a campus in Taiwan in Mandarin. We have another campus in Southeast Asia in Mandarin for the Chinese church, but we don't disclose its location and it moves around because of the CCP and issues with them. We have a campus in India now in the Hindi language. We're looking at one in Africa. So those are the training centers for Radius. But we had three purposes when we started Radius. One was the training centers. The other was to affect the conversation with regard to missions. And then the third was to inspire/educate the church with regard to missions. So a missionary has grown out of that. Missionary.com is a website, but missionary's focus is really on the inspiration of young people, of churches, et cetera, into missions. And then the education as to how you get that done, how you do that well. And so the first phase of that was these movies that we put out, these the series of six, which is a package that has a curriculum that goes with it. So for like a small group study or an adult Sunday school class, watch the documentary and then do that. And we picked six different missionaries into the documentaries on them. There's more coming. In fact, oh, wow. I was just reading this morning.
Oh, my pamphlet.
Right. I was present for the lecture, Camden, yeah. when you actually did this lecture on the Great Commission and God's unfolding plan yeah. of the nations. And so when you put out the printed version and gave it to me in Florida, I thought, well, I'll read it just before the podcast.
Yeah, sure.
Remind myself what you said.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the things that I'm working on is a, and that we want to get out by 2026, is a curriculum that will help the church understand God's unfolding plan and missions. And then it puts some practical feet to that. How do we get it done now? And so I read this morning and I thought, gosh, Camden is saying the same things I've been trying to say for
good.
Some time.
That's good.
And I was excited about that. I was reminded of the conference at Greenville and the fact that we were very much on the same page.
Yeah.
And I thought, I just need to call Camden and have him help me put together this
curriculum.
Let's do it. Yeah, we're looking at that. But we're looking at other measures as well.
Amen. Yeah, for what Chad's referring to is my little address to the ends of the earth, and that's available now. You can head to our website and get a copy of that. It's a short little pamphlet. But I have just been working, even just last night, I was working on typesetting our conference addresses from October. Reform Forum held our annual conference on the Great Commission. We titled it Ordinary Means, Extraordinary Ends, Word, Sacrament, and the Great Commission. And so we're working on a book. It should be done pretty soon. It's getting really close to being finished. But it includes all five addresses from that conference, which are each taking successive portions of the Great Commission and treating them exegetically, but in a very accessible way and winsome way. Still theologically rich, but it's not anything someone in a Reformed church would have trouble with. And then we're also planning to include at least two of the addresses from the Greenville pre-conference, one from the one that we just talked about from me to the ends of the earth, and then another that Jim taught on the Gospel of John. So that's going to be a little paperback book, about 150 pages, so we're excited to have that out. I'm just excited to hear more content about missions. I even heard Michael Morales' lecture from the conference that we alluded to in Jacksonville back in October, and it was very similar as well. Biblically, theologically, he was working with Isaiah 2, which is exactly what I worked with in there, and I'm just delighted. I'm hearing this. I'm like, oh, this is the same themes as well, but I wish all of us were talking this way.
That's right.
And Chad, I imagine that you know, it's such a refreshing thing, and it makes me rejoice because often the church doesn't think biblically, theologically, and has not necessarily, or we used to have it and we've lost it, but for whatever reason, in the last several decades, we haven't, I think the church as a whole hasn't seemed to have this comprehensive vision of missions and what we're seeking to accomplish, what the Lord's commanded us to do and what he's equipped us to do and what we're called to do, commanded to do for the sake of the gospel. So I'm glad. Anything you could do through missionary or Radius that would further those ends and get people to have that healthy vision, you know, I support that.
Well, that's our plan. You know, Carl Truman told me years ago that missions is often the tip of the spear of error in the church, sadly. Mm. And obviously we see that with Machen and how the OPC even started.
Yeah, right.
With that, the liberalism that was happening in missions. And it's interesting because I largely came into Reformed theology via missions, which is odd. But when you are training young people to go into the field and you realize they're unclear on what the gospel is, they're unclear on what the church is, they're unclear on what the mission of the church is, they're unclear on the means that God has given to the church. And then you start saying, who's helpful in all these areas? And it was always Reformed guys I was reading that were very helpful. And I want to ground this biblically.
Yeah.
Paul
yeah.
doesn't come up with these ideas out of midair. And frankly, even Jesus isn't just speaking out of it, you know, just dropping into midair and starting to speak. These things are grounded all the way back in Genesis. And so watching that unfold, seeing the resources that I received as I tried to think through these things, you know, reading Voss and reading Beale and reading Morales, and the Lord just slowly demonstrated to me that the resources are there. What was surprising to me is you all in the Presbyterian Reform world have provided the richest resources to tell us not only what the church ought to be doing, but how we ought to be doing it biblically. And then you're not doing very much of it anymore, though you used to, which is part of the reason we wanted to tell the story of Peyton.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, we were, what was the stat? I think it was Princeton Seminary back in the 19th century was sending out a third. It was a third of their graduates were going to foreign mission fields. One third. That's amazing. And gone are those days. And it's no secret that the OPC is, and we're not only OPC people here. A lot of people watch it from other denominations, even outside of NAPARC and ICRC. But at least for Ryan and I, as members of the OPC, we're going through a crisis. And we're trying to raise up more missionaries. We trust the Lord's going to provide on that front. But it at the very least, has caused us to be circumspect and to think about why is that the case? What are the challenges? What is going on? There's plenty of people that have the credentials and the ministerial office and calling to go do this work. What is blocking people from doing it? Whether that's governmentally, financially, familially, whatever. There's all sorts of factors, but I think it's, you know, we are doing good work. There are many fields out there, but we're lacking in the workers to go do the work as much of it as we would like. And I think there's just a totally culturally different way to think about missions than my grandmother used to think of it, for example. And yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of things we could talk about relative to that.
A lot. Brother, there's also a lack of, I think, education among pastors as to how they can tie missions into their sermons or their preaching regularly.
Yes.
Which is exactly what I think the work like the work you guys are doing, this book, 150-page book you're putting together, I'm anxious to see that. Because some of the work that you guys are doing, just even reading this little simple sermon that you turned into a pamphlet, I think if we see more of that kind of work, pastors can see so clearly missions isn't something I have to have an annual event for. I can just see this unfolding throughout the scriptures that God has sent his son to save people from every tribe and tongue and nation. And that's our job, not only to keep the gospel here, but to share it to the ends of the earth. Mm-hmm. And I think to some degree, we've started teaching, you know, we've kind of flipped Jesus' own mission statement in Matthew 16 on its head. I will build my church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. We've decided to go on the defense instead of the offense. And now it's more like, I won't let the gates of hell, no longer are they gates. It's like that hell's on the offense and we're building big gates, to defend our doctrine.
Yeah.
And we're forgetting that Christ is building his church.
Yeah.
And so I'm a little bit concerned that we stop, not that we stop defending our confessional faithfulness. I think we need to be confessionally faithful, but that we stop being so small-minded that we think that's our whole task. Actually, it's not just about guarding the gates of confessional faithfulness at all. In fact, it's about taking the earth that belongs to Christ. Mm-hmm. It's been given to him, and so we go and claim it. And I don't mean this in a post-millennial theonomist sense. I just mean going out and preaching the gospel and gathering the peoples into the church that belong to Christ.
Right. That's what I mean, too, in the that pamphlet. But afterward, my friend Tony Curto, who also spoke there, came up to me, and he was talking to Joey Piper, and they're both post-mill. But Tony came up to me, and he said, I talked to Joey, and when we heard the ending or conclusion of your address, we said, we've almost got him. But it doesn't – my point in that is I'm firmly, thoroughly amillennial, but that doesn't preclude us from being optimistic and to work with all the strength that the Lord provides to labor in his church. Like I'm an optimistic amillennial, but I view things spiritually, that the gospel will go forth and every single one of Christ's sheep will be called into his fold. In that sense, we cannot lose. Like what better pregame speech or mid or halftime speech could a coach give if he could guarantee this and told his players, Doesn't matter what things look like. You cannot lose. You will guaranteed win. Absolutely, you will win. Like, what more motivation could we have? We cannot lose, even in dying for the sake of the gospel. And if we do so in service of Christ, in faithful service to him, even that advances the sake of the gospel. So that should be a message every Christian holds to, regardless of their eschatology. But I think there is a bit of a touch point that Ryan and I, he a theonomist, me an amillennialist, or a postmillennialist, I should say. Pardon me, brother. But even though we could certainly, you know, have some differences in terms of the timing of the events of Scripture and the imminent return of Christ and those sorts of things, we can still wholeheartedly hold to this optimism and understanding, this firm conviction that Christ is going forth by his power and changing people and redeeming them and bringing them into his house.
One thing that I'm so excited about with regard to the docuseries and John G. Payton's autobiography and this whole discussion is that we're able to encourage folks to promote this global comprehensive vision for the advancement of Christ's kingdom, not just from the pulpit, as you mentioned a moment ago, Chad, which is the primary focus. We have to be doing that. If we're not doing that in the proclamation of the word, then we really cease to be distinctively the church, right? But one thing that comes through loud and clear in the docuseries and also the autobiography, I keep referring to it just because it means so much to me and has profoundly affected me, is that a zeal for global missions begins really for Payton in his own home. And one thing that you are seeking to do with this docuseries in a way that Camden and I have even seen fruit in our own homes as we've watched the one on Payton on the Christian Sabbath, is that it's promoting a healthy discussion about world missions among our children. And we've been challenged in the OPC, for example, not just to pray that the Lord would send us and raise up men in our congregation, but send our own sons. And so now I'm getting to ask my son, James, should I start praying for you that you would go to unreached peoples? And he said, I don't know, Dad. But he said it seriously because he's thinking about it. And so I'm so thankful for that, brother. And I wonder if, as we transition into thinking maybe more about the life and the ministry and the legacy of Payton, if you might bring us into what I think is it's hard to say it's the most compelling chapter of this book, but the first one on the home life.
It's astounding.
I got to get in touch with Banner of Proof and tell them to reprint this as just a pamphlet on family, piety, and worship. I wonder if you might bring us into Brayhead, the Scottish cottage village, and walk us into the father's prayer closet and the devotional life of this family that would make John G. Payton want to answer his father's own prayers. Right.
Well, I think there's a lot there. I mean, you're right. That chapter in the autobiography could be its own little booklet. And if Banner won't put it out, you know, maybe you all could.
Yeah, it's free. It's public domain. We can get it on Google Books.
That's exactly right. Public domain. I think it would be a great service to the church. Now that you're saying it, maybe I'll have missionary do it. Because we're starting a publishing house as well.
That's great.
But I agree with you 100%. It's moving because his father was so dedicated, and his mother, they were both so dedicated to family worship. And as you know, the mother was not able to go a lot of times on the Sabbath to church on the Lord's Day. And so he would walk the family there and walk them home and then re-preach the sermon and then walk them back in the evening and walk them home, which was miles to church there and back, walk them miles to hear the word and walk them back and then re-preach the sermon morning and evening since the wife was ill and unable to go. And they watched their father's, I think, commitment to making sure his wife knew the word and what she was missing and which on the Lord's Day. That was, I'm sure, impactful for Payton because he tells you that story. That we actually got to in the film, as you guys saw, we got to go to their little house with a thatched roof and film there on location. And it's small. It's really small. So when you imagine this large family in this little tiny home, it could for most of our homes, it'd be almost one room. Like if you think your living room or something at the most. And he has a little prayer closet in there he goes into to pray, and he prays loud. And Peyton talks about his loud prayers, not because he's making a show, but just because of earnestness and zeal. Yeah,
his passion.
And they can hear him crying out to the Lord. The consistency in family worship, the consistency in private prayer, the consistency in Lord's Day worship, and the way that impacted Peyton was profound. His parents talking about the gospel going to the nations. What was also interesting is Peyton talks about how when he was about to go out to Vanuatu, or what at the time was called the New Hebrides, his parents telling him that we prayed that the Lord would set you apart for this when you were little.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had no idea that that was the case. I think for me, that's one of the most profound parts in the autobiography, because I know men who've been there. Mm-hmm. I know people who live in those places now. I have two teams from my church in two of the most difficult places on earth. So when I count them up, you know, those are 8 adults and all their children in 2 different locations, and they suffer a lot. And it's difficult, and it's lonely, and it's hard. And you say goodbye, right? The hardest thing you do is not going to the mission field. It's if you send your children and grandchildren and standing at the airport watching them leave and realizing, I'm not going to share the comfort of my children and grandchildren for pretty much most of the rest of my life. So Peyton had some of his sons go into missions, which he asked the Lord to send him. And if you think about that, after losing a wife and a son and a couple other children and grandchildren, everything else in the field, John G. Peyton is still wanting his own sons to go.
It's extraordinary.
Right. And, I think about that and it's striking, but I think about that in the life of, you know, one of the primary lead co-founder of Radius, a guy named Brad Buser. He went to the Etete people for 20 years, which is a formerly cannibalistic tribe, and he lived among them. And then 2 of his sons went to 2 other people groups. So the BM and the Yembe Yembe. So one of those sons being Brooks Buser, who's mm-hmm. the president of Radius now, who's in the film with me. Brooks is in the film with me.
Yeah.
But he lived among the Yembe Yembe. Brad, his father, tells me the hardest thing he ever did in his life was put his kids, you know, his own sons and their wives and grandkids on a plane and realize, okay, I gave up the comforts of America and modern life for 20 years, and now I'm giving up the comforts of my children and grandchildren, and my reward will be in heaven, but I won't get to enjoy them in this life. And to think about that, that is so hard and so profound to me to think about John G. Peyton's father praying that the Lord would set him apart for that as a young child. You know, you look at your little children and you think, do I want them to be sent off to never enjoy their comfort again, or to see their children really? That's so moving. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, comes out in the film because we go there to his home, that little tiny house. And it's really impressive life and legacy of his father and mother, not just of him.
John G. Peyton, for just catch people up, definitely we would encourage you to check out the entire docuseries, but especially this episode from Missionary. Head over to missionary.com. Peyton is serving in the 19th century. He's a Scottish Presbyterian. And as Chad mentioned, he goes to a place called the New Hebrides, or present-day Vanuatu, which are these islands, if I recall, off the east coast, kind of northeast of Australia. And so there are these tiny islands. But Chad, if you don't mind explaining, you've alluded and mentioned a couple things in passing about Peyton arriving. And there were a couple other people that came with him prior, or not came with him, but other people that went to these same people prior. What was the experience like showing up at this island? And what did Peyton, once he got there, what did he experience within just a few months?
Yeah, so we got to go, and that's one of the great things about this docuseries.
You see it. Yeah.
You get to see it. You get to see where he went. We go to his first island. Well, we actually go to all 3 islands he would have gone to originally. So when he first arrives, he comes to what's now called Mystery Island. Anichum is what they call it there. Aneicham is where, you know, if from the Australian cruise ships will come in there. It's a really beautiful place. There was a pastor, a Presbyterian minister there named John Geddes or Geddes. I'm not exactly sure how to pronounce it, G-E-D-D-E-S. He was a Scottish Presbyterian who was there before Peyton, and he was on Aneicham. And actually, when I arrived, I got to go into his church, the church he planted, and it's full. It's full of people. It's still a thriving Presbyterian church right there on the island. When you pull up on the beach, you actually, the airstrip is on a little island off the island. It's a grass airstrip you land on, and then you get on a little boat and go across the ocean there just into the main island. When you pull on the beach, there's this Presbyterian church packed out, and it was planted by him. When Peyton first arrives there, he comes to Aneicham first, and then he goes down to Tanna, which is where he first does work, where his wife and child die. But there were missionaries who had gone before him. And I think you're referencing the two who had been clubbed to death and killed and then eaten.
Yeah. Welcome to the ministry. Yeah.
What's that?
I said, welcome to the ministry. They show up and as soon as they set foot on the island, they get clubbed to death and eat. One of them eaten, boiled up and eaten.
Yep. And that was one of the challenges in Peyton going. He had a very thriving ministry on Green Street in Glasgow. And a lot of people don't understand that. It was also one of the compelling parts for me. We went to Green Street and we went to that area and filmed. And it's a poor area. It's a difficult place to do ministry. And Peyton shows up there. And initially there are just a small handful of people who believe the gospel. And within his time there, his short time there, I mean, 1,000 people or so have come to Christ. And the church is thriving, and he's doing day-to-day evangelism, and he's got people coming in, and so the push against him is, why would you want to leave
with
this thriving Presbyterian ministry? People are being converted, and now you're going to go to the New Hebrides, and you're going to go to a place where some of our missionaries just got eaten by cannibals, and what are you thinking? What a waste of your life. You're endangering your life. You're giving up a successful ministry. We could all imagine the appeal. Hey, look at all these unbelievers coming to Christ around you. What are you doing? And of course, Peyton's heartbeat was, the people around me have access to the gospel. There are gospel preachers. There's a Bible in English. Their problem is that they're not interested in it. The people there have no access to it. There's no opportunity to even hear the gospel. They're not rejecting it yet. They haven't even had a chance to hear it. So I want to go where it hasn't been heard. And of course, he gets called out for, but you're going to be eaten by cannibals. And his famous line, I don't really have memorized, but in summary form is, whether I'm eaten by cannibals or eaten by worms doesn't really matter to me. I'm going to have the same resurrection body as you,
right.
Who would about to be eaten by worms. So he heads out. He goes to Tanna. Tanna's a beautiful island, active volcano, most active volcano in the world. So we walk on one side of that volcano, and you can see the smoke in the background.
Even the cinematography is gorgeous. Your team is phenomenal. I mean, it's even just for a piece of visual art, it's fun to watch. But then it's telling this wonderful story and encouraging us towards Presbyterian missions, which, how could you go wrong?
And you guys would be encouraged if you, now there are some things you would be discouraged by, but when you go to the New Hebrides, which is, it's about a 4-hour flight from Australia. So it's a little closer to Fiji than Australia. But if you're there, you're getting your milk from New Zealand, you know, your dairy products from New Zealand. So it's that region of the world. Every island we went to, Presbyterian. Come on there. What are you? I'm Presbyterian. Everywhere you go, because these Presbyterian missionaries that went there in the 19th century, it's really remarkable to see. Now, unfortunately, what happened is there was a lot of removal of the conservative Presbyterians from that area. And then followed them in as like liberal Presbyterians trying to convince all these people to be egalitarian. And so now they struggle to have trained ministers, and they're being told that women should pastor, and they're clear on the gospel still, thankfully. But that's unfortunate, you know, what's developed there as a result. So
it's one of the most encouraging things when I was watching the series, speaking with my children, and telling them, look, there's an elephant ministry, the fruit of an elephant ministry, not a quick rabbit one that burns out or gets eaten by wolves. Not just a fire that you light and goes out, but as Mark Dever said in the documentary, a furnace that burns and lasts. And we see it 100+ years later, people worshiping our triune God in this place that was just heathens less than 200 years ago. So, brother, I wonder if you might bring us into some of the obstacles, some of the challenges that John G. Payton faced while he was on the island, and then point us to his faith in God's sovereignty, to the sweetness of the communion that he had with Christ, such that he could have a perfect peace even while he's literally surrounded by cannibals waiting to sacrifice him, to eat him, or he's up in a chestnut tree while there's all hell breaking loose below. Bring us into some of those scenes that are so powerful, and tell us a bit about how this was like Calvinism put to life. You know, what does God's sovereignty mean for the missionary in these unreachable places?
Yeah, Ryan, if I had known you, we probably would have interviewed you for the film. You get a little piece of you with all your fire there for the documentary is one of our interviews.
That's right,
but,
man.
You know, it was – so we came to Tana, his first island, 4+ years he's there, and then he's run off by the cannibals. But what we show there, and you can see in film I wish you could experience in a multi-sensory fashion and not just see it and hear us talk about it. Because we come to Tana, it's a beautiful island, active volcano. On the one side of the volcano where we're walking, where it's everything's dead, and you know, you can tell the volcano overflows and you've got the smoke and it's incredible. And we do have a first-rate cinematography and editing and audio and all that. But we see that. On the other side, you see where we go to visit the grave of his first wife and child. And, you know, to give people some context, where that grave is there's a little bay that comes in from the ocean there. And it's near the beach of that bay. But it's actually on the other side of the volcano. And so you can still feel the rumbling of the volcano there. And he lived there. What you don't see and smell, you can kind of see it, but the area reeks. It's terrible. Like, we had to go through dense jungle. And the people there knew where Payton's wife and child were buried. That's the amazing thing. You know where John Payton's wife and child were buried? Yes, we do. Like really? That's incredible. So nobody had been there for years and years and years. So they took us back in there. And you realize this brother lived in this area that was hot, humid, beautiful, but swelteringly humid, hot. There are nasty bugs and mosquitoes everywhere. It's the stench is overwhelming. It smells a little bit like death there. And you think, this guy moved here and lived here for years. And then we come to the grave of his wife and son where he buried them. And then as if you've read the autobiography, you know, he lays on their grave for some time to protect them. He lays in their grave to protect them from, you think just laying there to weep, that's no. Not the whole issue, right? Yeah. He's laying there to protect them from being eaten by the cannibals, his wife and son.
Yeah.
The loneliness of that. They try to burn his house down. They tree him at one point. He hides in a tree. This is a miserable existence for 4+ years. They finally run him off the island.
Yeah.
But he continues to trust in the Lord. You know, you talk about the chestnut tree. He goes up in that tree and speaks about how he's there all night waiting for these people to potentially kill him.
Yeah, he was tipped off by another tribe member that said, these guys are going to come tonight and kill you. And so he jumped into the tree, right?
He is. And he's not sure if he had any converts on that island.
Yeah.
All that suffering, one guy maybe that may have been a convert. And all that suffering, 4 years, he got diseases multiple times with sickness. The fact that you survive that kind of sickness over and over and over again, malaria and, you know, all the kinds of things you're going to get is remarkable. So he was a stout guy, obviously a physically stout guy. but he's treed up there and he's just talking about knowing the presence of the Lord. Like, I would spend every day in that tree, to, if you will, to know the presence of the Lord like I knew that night as he cared for me. Yeah. And he says that he knew until the Lord was done with him, he was invincible. So he wasn't fearing what was going to come of his life because he was invincible until the Lord is done with him. Mm-hmm. And I think understanding that doctrine of divine providence, the sovereignty of God, he has a purpose for your life. Mm-hmm. He's numbered all your days. There's not going to be one less than what he's given you. So you don't have to cower in fear. He's present with you.
Right.
And I think Peyton knew that really well, to the point, to the extent that when he left that island, you would think he would just go home and say, I'm going to go back to Green Street and start that successful ministry again, and I'll be received as a hero. But what he does instead is he goes and spends the next few years recruiting Presbyterians in Australia and Scotland to go into missions, telling his story. And one in six, think about this, one in six of the active ministers in his Presbyterian denomination leave the ministry where they are and go to unreached peoples. Could you imagine if one in six OPC ministers walked away right now to go reach unreached peoples?
Wow.
That's just remarkable. Mm-hmm. He raises money and then he goes back and he goes to Aniwa, which, you know, we could talk about in a minute, but that's the first phase of his ministry.
Right. He shows up is with a wife with a child, pregnant, and he delivers this baby. Baby dies, you know, gets a fever and dies. His wife dies in childbirth. I think that the child died a little later with a fever,
child
or vice versa.
That.
Yeah. And then, yeah, he has to bury them both and then sleep on their graves so they don't get dug up and eaten. And then, yeah, but what you just mentioned, the moment where he's up in that all night in a chestnut tree hiding from the men who came to his house to kill him is probably the most, for me, it was the most moving portion of the entire episode, especially when Mark Dever and John Piper were talking about it. Just to understand that verse of the Lord speaking through Paul, that Paul understood that God's grace is perfect in weakness. And just to understand that Peyton never felt closer to the Lord than in the moment when he is perhaps closest to being put to death by those who would kill him for his faith and for his work. And just to see that how, you know, the danger, the trouble, the need has never been greater, and how the Lord abundantly provided for that need what he needed. His grace is sufficient. And
yeah.
I just thought, oh my goodness. I mean, that's true for all of us all the time. But just to see how he had that heavenly perspective and an understanding that indeed he was invincible, not in a reckless way where he's, you know, jumping off cliffs or doing crazy stuff, but I guess it's crazy from our American perspective in some ways, but he understood that his usefulness was in trusting the Lord and laboring to serve, and that no matter what he might be afraid of or what somebody might do to him, if the Lord had work for him to do, it would be accomplished in and through him, and nothing could stop that.
Yeah, it's remarkable. His life is remarkable. The reason we wanted that is the sixth episode. So Missionary put it together six episodes. Mm-hmm. The first one starting with Tyndale and him giving his life for translation of scripture, which is a fun episode. You guys would enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Cinematography wise, it's probably the most stunning episode. Because of the architecture in England and Belgium and Scotland, you know, some of those, well, Northern England, some of the various places. And then we did a series of them. So the last one we end with Peyton. And we watched them with my family. My family, you know, knows that I had put together most of these stories. I didn't write the scripts, but I put together, I think, half of these particular stories. And then I've done another one on Adoniram Judson, which we haven't been able to film yet because of the Civil War there. But I'm looking forward to doing that one. We're filming one on the St. Andrew's Seven this summer, which has been put together. We're working on one on Princeton as well, Old Princeton, with their missions efforts. So that we're looking forward to that. So those are upcoming. We'll add to the series is what I'm saying. But we wanted to put Peyton last in part because his story is so remarkable and just really gets the point of which we wanted to get at, which is he's ready to lay it all down to see the gospel go to people who've never heard it.
Mm-hmm.
We ask at the end of the first episode with Tyndale, hey, there's well, and you know, there's debates about this, but let's say 3,100 or so language groups that have no access to the gospel. And we ask the question, who will be their Tyndale?
Mm-hmm.
Episode one, that's how we end it. Who will be their Tyndale? Episode six is, well, John G. Payton was the Tyndale to Aniwa, right? I mean, he's the church planting, Bible translating guy who goes to Aniwa and lays it all down. And it's remarkable. My family, even though I was in it, and I went to film these places and I helped put together the story. It's still, when I sat and watched this episode with my family, we all sat there stunned and quiet at the end of it. It's like, wow. Oh my, this guy's life is just remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a clarity. You said that, Camden, of his kind of heavenly mindedness.
Mm-hmm.
That acted out in his life. There's a kind of clarity about his eternal reward,
mm-hmm.
and his, you know, that is, it's compelling and it's convicting.
Yeah, we're called to see with new eyes, to walk by faith, not by sight. And I'm just always overwhelmed by brothers and sisters, you know, at times, who seem to have that kind of locked in vision. And that's partly why, and one of the main reasons why I love John Piper so much. You instantly hear him, at least for me. He's always spoken to me in a particular way. The Lord's used him in my life in various moments. But even just watching him in this series and then hearing him speak at the conference that we attended, that missionary put on back in October, I was just reflecting and smiling. So here's a true believer. You know, just so, I mean, obviously we are true believers, we trust in the Lord, but there's a genuineness to him that I aspire toward and wish that things were that simple. And I don't pretend to think that John's everyday life is always as simple and locked in as I think. I imagine he's a normal person who struggles with normal things as well. But my point is that sometimes we often complicate things too much in life, and we don't see things with the eyes of faith. And it seems to me that Payton was the kind of guy who walked by faith and assessed his life and situations and what he ought to do with that simple, and I don't mean simplistic, but I mean that simple faith in the Lord that just you see with new eyes. And whereas even as his colleagues would say, you're crazy, you're insane for leaving this ministry, the Lord seems to bless it, is blessing it. Why would you go to these cannibals? So the Lord's calling me to do this. These people don't have a Bible. I'm going to go give them one. So what's holding us back from that? You know, our retirement accounts, you know, heating and air conditioning, modern medicine. I mean, there's a lot of things, but somebody needs to go do this work because it's what we're called to do. And it's real easy to point fingers and say, well, somebody will do it. Well, the better question is, why not me?
Yeah, I think one of the things holds us back is commitment to family. We have gone from, it's the husband's duty, and I believe this 100%, you know, and father's duty to care for his wife and children, to provide for them, to protect them, et cetera. We've gone from that to a kind of extreme. Therefore, you shall never take them into any difficult context or situation.
Right. Yeah,
It's a very uniquely kind of modern Western, you know, comfort that we have, and expectation that we have that comes along with that. That ministry should never be difficult because I have a family, you know, and they shouldn't go through difficulty. They should thrive. Like, this is a big thing in ministry. You know, you should thrive. And I'm like, gosh, Paul never talks about thriving in ministry. He talks about persevering, like making it through, you know, like, and I think we're afraid of just talking about enduring, right? Yeah. Like, just enduring. That doesn't sound very exciting as a, you know, ministerial conference title, endure, right? Like, you know,
persevere.
Just yeah. make it, you know?
It.
Like, so,
yeah.
So I think that, he's remarkable. Payton, by the way, one of the things you guys don't get to see, although we do have a behind the scenes on Payton. Have you guys seen that?
No.
Oh yeah. There's a 15 minute, I think, or so behind the scenes on YouTube.
Okay.
You guys would enjoy on the missionary.com.
We'll take a look
channel,
at the channel
on YouTube.
We'll put a link
you
to that.
You guys would
in
enjoy it. You get to see a lot more of the behind the scenes on the Peyton film. That's the one we did a behind the scenes on. You'll get to see some things you didn't get to see in the film that are really interesting to you, will probably be interesting to you. When we fly into Aniwa, you don't get to see this in the behind the scenes, which is a bummer to me. But when we flew into Aniwa, we land on this grass airstrip. They hadn't seen a white guy in at least 10 years, at least 10 years. This is the island that Peyton finally lives on for about 14 years and plants the Presbyterian church there. And when we show up, we're walking along and we start talking to some of the islanders and they come out to us. And because of Brooks Buser being with us and Brooks having been in Papua New Guinea, he knew a form of pidgin. And so they knew pidgin, a different form. So they talked to him like he sounded like their drunk uncle to them in some way. But they were laughing because they hadn't seen a white guy walk on their island and just start talking to them.
Yeah.
And they could interact. And so that made a lot of fun because he was asking for locations like, hey, where did John G. Peyton first, where was his first church? And where was the first place you had the Lord's Supper? And where did he dig the well, right? That the islanders thought he was going to fall through the well
right,
into the
fall
ocean.
Through the earth into the, yeah.
Yeah. Where did he dig the well? And do you remember who he is? And can you explain the gospel? Brooks just asked them to explain the gospel to see if they still knew it. And, you know, you land on the island, they all know who John G. Peyton is. There's nobody there who didn't know who he was. And, you know, you think that's 120 years ago, give or take, by the time he's done there. And we're walking on. They can clearly articulate the gospel. They took us to both First and Second Presbyterian Church on the island. you see them both. They had the first church that he planted was down lower. And in the island, and that was, you see where the original site was, and they have a monument for the first time they had the Lord's Supper as a people that's in the ground there that we got to film, and they have a monument for the well is, where some of Peyton's even grandchildren died. They have these little tiny rock headstones. You can barely see where some of his grandkids died. It was remarkable. And then they have a new Presbyterian church is up higher on the island, but it's not because of a split. It's just because of location.
Mm-hmm.
But to walk among them and speak with them and talk with them about Peyton, they knew the stories. They knew the locations. It was amazing. It was amazing. Yeah. So we get some behind the scenes on some of that, as well as some of the stuff in Vanuatu and some of the places we fly to in Anaichum. And so you guys would enjoy that. Yeah,
well,
you'd enjoy
we're
that.
Watch it.
Definitely
certainly.
Have to check it out. Yeah, what a legacy of spiritual children Peyton has left behind. And we were talking earlier about, you know, locking in with the heavenly mindedness and a zeal for the Lord. And one thing I thought was so remarkable about Peyton's autobiography is not his time on the mission field, which was remarkable, but his time fundraising, his time going to Sunday schools, his time going to Baptists, to Presbyterians, to women's, you know, societies, to Sabbath schools, and seeking to stir up a love of God among the people and a zeal for his gospel that it just seems missing in some ways today. And I'm really hopeful, brother, that through the work of this docuseries and more broadly with missionary, that we can get the whole church, even little kids, excited about participating in the mission of the gospel. You know, I my heart is just set aflame when I read about, you know, children sacrificially contributing like a half pence weekly, and all of a sudden that adds up to $300, and Peyton can, you know, set aside funds to buy a ship to go back over to preach to the heathen. We need to just get people excited about participating in the work of the church. Not everyone is able to, you know, go over there, but we can all pray, we can all contribute, we can all seek the Lord together in this way.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think your last point, not everyone can go over there, is right. I mean, you have to have a certain grittiness, kind of, you know, stoutness to do this job. I mean, you can't be, you're not generally going to be a physically weak person in the sense of being having a lot of ailments easily, or you're probably not going to get it done. I'm not saying you're absolutely ruled out, but but it's a little less likely for you. So, but you can do your part. And this is part of the thing. The church has been given the Great Commission, not just a 20-year-old college student who goes to cross and gets excited, but the church has been given the Great Commission, and we send and we go together. And there's a sense in which you may not be the person the church sends as the missionary, but you are a fellow worker in the gospel with that person when you send them well as a member of that church. And I think getting people to take up a kind of seriousness about how we teach our children, like you're pointing to, how we instruct our church, how we send well. I have a family right now that they have two incomes. Their kids are old enough that they have two incomes, but they spend one income to live, and they put the other income into supporting missionaries. And they're saying, well, our missionaries are making sacrifices to go, so we want to make sacrifices to send them as part of the church. And I think there's a kind of seriousness about how we send people that we can take up as well, right? So I want elders to start to get in their minds that, hey, we should look around at the young people in this church and ask the question, who are the up and coming, you know, especially like look at the young men, who are the up and coming young men that we want to, we don't want to wait for them to go to a conference and hear John Piper or whoever and get all fired up. We actually want to go up to them and say, hey, brother, you know what? We see a lot of good work of God's grace in your life. We want you to consider being a gospel minister, either here or abroad. And by the way, when we say either here or abroad, what we mean by that is not you come up with a dream as to what you would like to do pastorally, and then you self-send to that place. what we mean is, you're a soldier in God's army of gospel ministers, and the general of the army doesn't ask the location you to, you know, kind of give them location to where you'd like to be allocated. The general sends you where he needs you, and he does that through the church. And so you go get trained, and then as elders, we're going to tell you, you should go into foreign missions, and you just go, okay, I'll go. If you read J.W. Alexander, John Layton Wilson, who Greenville's, you know, press, Log College Press just put out his book, J.W. Alexander from Early Princeton Days, they're going to tell you a gospel minister who's not willing to go to a foreign field, he's like, I want to go to my home church, but he won't be allocated wherever the Lord needs him, is not qualified to be a gospel minister. Because actually just looking after his own interests, not the interest of seeing the gospel go to people. And they were constantly telling these young men at Princeton, you don't get to go wherever you want to go. You go where the Lord sends you. Mm-hmm. And if the greatest need is in the foreign mission field, then you go there. And I think we don't talk that way anymore. We look at gospel ministers, we say, what seminary would you like to go to? They sort of self-send them themselves to seminary. And then while they're there, they kind of come up with what they want to do with their life after. And it's kind of this enterprise of largely self-sending. And there's very little input from the church anymore, I think, as to sending men to particular locations.
Yeah, it is an issue. And, you know, if someone has some charisma and can sell their vision to people, that seems to be what works, but it's a lot more perhaps taken from the discipline of marketing than it is necessarily from spiritual disciplines. Not to say that there isn't any way that obviously a lot of good comes from that too, but it's a completely different mindset. And you're right, thinking about being enlisted in the Lord's army, you are a worker, a servant, and he tells you where to go. That doesn't mean you never communicate maybe what you would like, because the Lord would also speak and inflame certain desires in your heart. But yeah, of course, we all agree on that. But I appreciate that point. And yeah, we don't think like that, you know. No, and that's probably the big need we have right now.
That's right. I agree with you that, you know, you have desires and the Lord gives you some of those desires. Some of them he doesn't.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, right. But I think that we default so heavily toward what's my dream and vision for my life, et cetera. I'm kind of wanting to push against that. Sometimes I may push overly hard against it, but I'm going to push against it because it's such a heavy default.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing when we're raising children. So you keep coming back to that, Ryan, that question of, you know, your children and looking around at the children in your Sunday school and the children in you know, your family worship, and you're asking questions about their lives. And I think most parents are thinking, how do I get them into the best college? How do I get them, set them up for the best future? Very few are looking at them saying, are these potential gospel ministers? Should I be preparing them for that? Should I be praying the Lord sets them apart to that? And I don't think elders are asking that about young people in their church. I don't think parents are asking that about their children. Right. We're mostly thinking about how to keep going along in this sort of nice, comfortable world, which I don't begrudge the fact that the Lord has blessed us in those ways. Right. I enjoy it. Look, I mean, I'm sitting here with bookshelves behind me and books, and, you know, I enjoy that as much as anybody else, but I don't know how many of us are really praying, okay, Lord, maybe my kids.
Amen.
You know,
we ought to.
So, yeah.
Chad, what are some next steps? I want to at least leave people with some calls to action, but some people may be wondering what to do next. I mean, whether that's information gathering, finding out more. You've already provided quite a few encouragements to elders, to parents, to help raise up and inculcate, you know, a mission mindset among our people and among our families. But what are some other things people might be able to do in terms of learning more, or if somebody might aspire towards mission work, obviously doing so in accordance with their church, but how might they reach out or think about potential formal training in those disciplines?
Yeah, well, I don't do this to plug Missionary or Radius expressly, but just we're creating the channels or the avenues we're creating. And you understand this, Camden. We're creating the avenues we're creating because we think they're helpful. So I would
think
tell
they're
you,
helpful too, brother. That's why we're
talking to you,
brother. Serious. I mean, we want to promote your work because it's being used by the Lord.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I would encourage families to sit down and watch this whole docuseries.
Yeah.
It'll be available streaming everywhere starting December 30th, but right now, you can get it at missionary.com. You can buy a package that has a Bible study.
You're going to want the literature that comes with it, the booklet.
Yeah. There's a leader's guide and some you know, participants' guides that we put together. There's a little daily family thing you could do, or personally, or as a family. But I would tell people to watch that series with their families or with their small group and talk about it. Discuss what does the Lord want us to do with this, pray through it. I tell people, young people all the time, if they're interested in missions, to get out their Bible and journal or whatever and start reading through the scripture and pay attention to the Lord's clear intention from not only the creation account that his glory would cover the earth as the waters cover the seas, it's there, but from the moment that we sin, the announcement of the seed of the woman is an announcement that the second Adam, you know, the Messiah is going to come and accomplish what the first Adam failed to do and what we've failed to do, et cetera. The God's glory will cover the earth as the water covers the seas. That's going to be a gospel ministry. Start reading through the scriptures and pay attention to that biblical story as it unfolds and see what the Lord wants for the nations and start praying through that. Lord, would you have me do this? Go talk to the elders at your church, you know, go see your session and ask them tell them, I think that maybe the Lord wants to do this with me. What do you men think of me? Am I the kind of person you would even want to start to train or to send? Because I think that's the first place, is not, I'm just excited about it, but does my own church see me as somebody that they would want to train or send? I tell young people all the time, maybe the first thing the elders are going to say to you is, actually, we're not saying no to you now, but we're saying not yet. You need to become a more useful member of our own church, right? Like, if it doesn't cost your church to send them, then they're probably not going to be a benefit to anybody else, right? So you want them to be, are you reaching out to unbelievers? When's the last time you brought someone to our church from outside of our church? In other words, are you out there actively engaging this ministry? Mm-hmm. John G. Payton is doing evangelism before he's ever going overseas. And you're not going to go to a context that's really difficult where you could potentially be imprisoned and suddenly get evangelistic zeal. It isn't going to happen. So you better start doing some of it now.
Oh, I love that. With regard to evangelism, certainly we have this idea, well, you know, I'm struggling to do these things now, but if I get in the mission field, all of a sudden some sort of switch is going to flip and I'm going to become outgoing and desirous of sharing the gospel with these people. It's not the case. It doesn't just happen that way.
That's right. And I think elders should push, like a session should push on young people who are interested in, hey, get out there and start doing some evangelism in our community. Start bringing people to church. Well, these people don't know the gospel. Great. Get a small, like one of the things I encourage, because it's one of the ways we train people to teach the gospel to unreached languages or people who've never heard it, is, hey, get a basic biblical theology and begin in Genesis 1 and meet with these unbelievers and start telling them the story.
Yeah.
Because they don't know who God is. They don't know what man is. Like, they don't know any of these questions. Right. So when you get to, why is Jesus the answer? Well, Jesus is only the answer if you're asking the right question,
right?
And so you've got to help them see that. So we encourage young people to do that. So I would encourage sessions to press on their young folks to do some of that. Be good members, be good evangelists, start doing some of that work now. But I would tell you, not only should we do that with our kids, so the missionary series is one way, reading through your Bible, approaching your session about potentially going if you're a young person. I think as parents, starting to pray that the Lord would be pleased to raise up gospel ministers in your own home from these children.
Yes, I think that's important, really important. I in following up with the Peyton episode and thinking about the work of Radius and the general work of reaching unreached people groups. I was doing some searches online and headed over to Joshua Project, and I've known about them before. I don't know much about the organization, the way that they find they do their data or anything. So I'm not advocating for that, or perhaps Chad, you can speak more to it. But the point of the project is to track and provide statistical updates about unreached people groups around the world. So I just popped in there and saw how many there are. I dove down on their map toward my area. Lo and behold, there are about 8 unreached people groups within an hour of me in the Chicagoland area. Now, I don't know all of what this means, but there are transplants and people that have moved from, there's a particular group, a Mexican mountain culture, the Huichol, who are nearby. There's a population of 6,400. They speak the language of Huichol, H-U-I-C-H-O-L, and it's an ethnic religious group near me. Now, I don't know what that means, or if they have other people that are still indigenous or and living in Mexico. Apparently, they do live in the Sierra Madre, Occidental Mountains of Western Mexico. My point is, maybe you can reach unreached people groups near your house. And that's important too. And we tend to have this all or nothing vision maybe of missions, where we think the Great Commission is, you know, the real people doing the real work are the guys that are moving to some place and going across the world to do that. That's important. That needs to be done. But the work of the Great Commission has been given to the whole church, involves not only foreign missions, but home missions and Christian ed. You could do the work of the Great Commission in your church. But even if you feel called or desirous of particular language work and doing that that work to provide people a written language and then ultimately to translate God's word into their heart language, I don't know this. I'm no expert. You might be able to do that with people nearby.
Yeah, you may. So we're doing a new people group index at Missionary. That's one of our plans. We actually have a meeting that next week to do a new index of language groups, because we're a little concerned about some of the definitions and how the research is done.
Yes.
And it has to be fairly continually updated.
Yes.
Because there are languages, for example, that are going extinct. In other words, they're just adopting the majority language group language, and so that's going away. We're not opposed to that. That's great, because then they have resources immediately. Mm-hmm. As a people. But then there are languages that don't have any access. So I do think the reason we would, for example, at Radius say, well, that's great, you have those people in Chicago, and we don't think there's anything wrong with going and learning their language and sharing the gospel with them. But our priority is going to be to train you to go to the mountain in Mexico where they're from.
Ultimately,
for example,
yes.
That area.
Yes.
Because they don't tend to go back.
Right.
They tend to go from there to America. And but, you know, so we're like, okay, let's go reach them. Yes. And then they're going to send people here anyway, because they're going to get out of there. Right? Yes. Everybody would like to get to America to some degree. So we're going to emphasize that. But yeah, if you can learn language and you have the skills to go do that, and they're right there next to you. I mean, I don't know why a church wouldn't be interested in that work, but it's a much bigger work than just, hey, there's an unreached language there. Let's send some people over, you know, with some tacos and see how things go, right? Like, you need to move in and get to know them. I mean, it's a big commitment that we want people to engage in. But you're exactly right, Camden, that they're all around. And I think a church that is engaging in the Great Commission in the sense of, maybe I'll put it in the language of saturation, I need to saturate my city with the gospel. That church is also going to be thinking about the places where there is no access whatsoever.
Right.
Those two things go hand in hand. They're not opposed to each other. They're complementary to each other. And I think we need to be doing all of that.
Yeah. I agree. Yes. My point, not so much to speak to the particular technical outworkings of this the ministry. And obviously, if we're going to be learning a language and translating the scriptures into a language, you do need to be part of the entire culture. I appreciate all of that. I just want to encourage people, as we all have already spoken of and agree, that the work of missions is everywhere. and there's all sorts of needs that we can seek to meet, whether in our culture or outside our culture, or outside our culture next door, or even the work that needs to be done in our own home. So that being the case, even if we aren't called to be sent to go to another people group to do the kinds of work that Peyton was doing, the kinds of work that Radius International will equip people to do that is very needed, we all can engage in the work of this ministry, lowercase m, to share the gospel of Christ to the ends of the earth. And the ends of the earth isn't just out there, but also That's might right. be next door. So I appreciate that. Well, thank you, brother.
By technical definition, we're definitely a part of the ends of the earth, aren't we?
We are.
I mean, if you're going back to Acts 1:8,
yes,
we're not Jerusalem, Judea, or Samaria. Yeah. So we aren't. Those are historical places. We're not them.
Absolutely. Right? So that needs to be done here too. And a lot of times, places that the gospel has gone to and had great effect have lost it. You know, you think of so much of Central Europe, for example, and maybe we need to go back to places.
Or even Scotland.
Scotland, yes.
Speaking about Peyton's, you know, home country.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. We need to stop seeing church planting in general as an endeavor of finding a group of people already committed to Reformed theology and then starting a church among them and saying that we church planted. Yeah. I want to say, okay, that's great, but hey, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of unbelievers right around you. Are you reaching any of them?
Right.
Or are you just finding affinity groups of people already committed to your confession? Mm-hmm. Those are not the same thing. Mm-hmm. And I think we used to have a better understanding of this than we presently do. Mm. Missions in general, Westminster Confession 1.8, right? Chapter 1, paragraph 8, we're committed to Bible translation among the vulgar languages, confessionally committed to it. And so I'm looking at going, hey, we need to step up. And I think evangelistically, we need to think about church planting much more offensively, going out there and reaching unbelievers, preaching the gospel to them, bringing them in, and a little less, hey, let's find the disgruntled evangelicals who are tired of the shallow stuff and get them in.
Yeah.
Listen, and I'm perfectly happy to find sheep who aren't being well fed and well cared for coming into our church. I'm happy to do that. But I'm also a little bit concerned when that becomes all that we really do. We get known for that,
right?
And not for coming after, going after lost people.
Amen. Well, let's gird up our loins and get to work. Mm-hmm. I appreciate this, Chad. I always love speaking with you, and I'm always left encouraged and motivated. And Ryan as well. Thank you so much. We'll point people to the various places they need to go. We'll have all ample links, not only to missionary.com and Radius International and the particular docuseries we've been speaking about, but also to Peyton's autobiography, which is available at archive.org and Google Books. You can get it. You can also buy a really nice bound version. It might be harder to, I think it's still for sale
and
imprint.
They're reprinting it.
Banner of Truth. Yep. So that's a great series, and other resources. We're really thankful. So thanks, Chad, for taking the time this morning. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, brothers. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Amen. Well, head on over to reformedforum.org. You'll find links to all the pertinent resources, as well as information about our upcoming events. Again, remember, December 20th, 2024, we're having our Christmas extravaganza with all sorts of guests, fun games, and a good time. So find the information there at reformedforum.org. We want to thank everybody for listening and for watching, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.